This episode of Voices of the Elephant is sponsored by DayCamp for Developers. Listen for a special offer at the end of this podcast. Welcome to the Voices of the Elephant podcast. Each episode of Voices of the Elephant brings you an interview with a member of the PHP community. From project leaders to user group organizers, we talk to the people that are helping make the PHP community special. Hi, we're here today with Bill Carwin. Bill, you and I worked together back at Zend oh so long ago. You were Zend Framework Manager number 2 or 3, I believe. Do you remember which it was?
I think it was 3. Thanks very much, Cal. Great to hear from you.
It's good to hear from you. But, you know, every time I see your name, I always think of one term basically as SQL, because you are just one of my go-to people whenever I have SQL questions. So today we're going to talk a couple of things about SQL. But first, I have a very interesting I read a very interesting blog post that you wrote back in April of 2010. You talked about something called second system syndrome. Can you describe for us what second system syndrome is, and why do you think Zend Framework 2 is, or at least was at that time, falling into it?
Well, it's also a tongue twister. Second system syndrome, or second system effect, is a term I got from The Mythical Man Month, a book by Frederick Brooks Jr.
Excellent book.
Yeah, and it's a great concept. The concept is people do one project and they have to make some cut corners, or they learn things along the way. They know better what they would have put into the project if they'd had more time and more freedom. And then they get an opportunity. The same people get an opportunity to do a very similar project over again. And they say, now's our opportunity to do all the things that we thought we would like to have done if we had had the opportunity to begin with. And they go for it. But the problem is they are engineers. So a lot of their goals and things that they wish for the projects are all internal engineering related features. And they sort of put everything into that project. I really wish that we could have used Git instead of subversion. I really wish that we would have used distributed processing or dependency injection or XML. All these are implementation details of how you would design and implement a project, but it has very little to do with what value does that project hold for any of its users. What problems are you trying to solve with this project, and why do you need to do it over again in order to solve those? What problems did you not solve in the first time around that you now wish you could? Sort of defining the use cases for the technology instead of the architecture and implementation of how you're going to do it. And that's what I was seeing in Zend Framework 2.0, that a lot of the discussion was going around, this is a year and a half ago now, about what implementation details do we want to do with this new version of Zend Framework. So they were going into a lot of the weeds about the architecture, features, dependency injection, PHP 5.3 features, and so on, none of which had to do with or described the problem that the framework was supposed to solve for developers. And that's what I saw as that issue. So I wrote a blog and a tweet that got a little bit of attention, and I talked with Matthew offline, and he and I get along great, and it was a lot of fun to discuss those issues with him, and he took a different direction with the planning of Zend Framework 2.0. Because of that, in a horizontal project like Zend Framework 2.0, you have inevitably a little bit of that sort of architectural discussion, because that is part of the value that you're giving to developers. It's making it easy to use as a framework for your own application development. So the users are themselves developers, and they're going to be involved in the architecture. So it's a bit of a gray area when it comes to frameworks. But that's the concept. And that's the effect of the second system effect, is that the engineers who have this dream of making it perfect sort of go off a cliff of complexity and adding in all the features and losing sight of the original goal.
One of the examples that you gave that I really kind of brought it home to me was namespaces, and how namespaces are a cool thing to have, but they're not going to add that much value to it for the amount of work that they were putting into it.
Exactly. One of the things that Frederick Brooks talks about is when you're making decisions about features to put into your perfect new project, is to be very clear and disciplined about how much code you're going to write to justify a given feature. If there's some feature that gives very little value, but it would take a lot of code to implement, maybe you shouldn't do it.
Oh, yeah. Excellent point. Now, surely you don't think that Zen Framework is the only one, because I don't want to seem like we're beating up on Zen Framework. Is this a problem you see in other frameworks, or is it truly just a Zen Framework issue?
No, it happens in all sorts of projects, frameworks, applications, operating systems, and so on. It's sort of creeping featureism or featureitis that designers haven't been specific enough in the use cases for which they're designing the software or the users who will be using it. So they pretty much try to create something that will handle everybody's needs simultaneously, and they end up creating something that's too heavyweight and bloatware. Microsoft Word is a great example. How many features of indexing and automatic table of contents generation and additional dictionaries and style sheets that do we use every day in Microsoft Word? Most of us just want a simple word processor, but it has become this huge project because it's trying to handle the needs of too many different types of users and writers.
Excellent point. And honestly, I could go on and talk about this for quite some time because I find it fascinating, but we do need to move on. Like I said in the intro, you work an awful lot with SQL and with databases. That's where I know you best from. You wrote the initial Zend_DB library or class system for Zen Framework, which I found was just absolutely beautiful. But looking beyond Zen Framework, looking at projects, not frameworks, looking at PHP-based projects, what's the biggest mistake that you see project developers making when it comes to SQL?
Great. I've been working with databases and SQL for quite a long time, probably 17 years now, and both as a trainer, developer, support, consulting. Right now I'm working at Percona, which is a MySQL consulting company that also makes Percona Server and ExtraDB. And so I get to see a lot of projects where people are using MySQL and databases in general at all levels, either small startups, one-man shops, all the way up to multi-billion dollar companies. And I think I could go on and on about the pitfalls that they run into, but I think the unifying principle is that they fail to plan for success. I remember an IBM television commercial where it depicts some people in a startup company, and they work like crazy, and they finally deploy their website, their online e-commerce website, and they all gather around the terminal, and the little counter goes bing, one order placed by a customer, and everybody cheers, and then it says two, and everybody cheers. And then it starts rolling and rolling and rolling, and soon they have 65,000 orders, and they're like, oh, we didn't think that would happen. So I think the failure to plan for success is the sort of unifying thing. And that has a lot of aspects that come out of it. For instance, metrics and monitoring. How do you know when your database is getting too large? How do you know which are your top queries or your most busy tables in your database? How do you plan for scalability, both in traffic and in size of data? And all other aspects, time, space, computation, et cetera. How do you do archiving? How do you run backups? How do you upgrade the system, either your operating system, the database software, individual features, schema features, like creating a new index. How do you do that without interrupting your 24/7 website? Mm. How do you do failover? So all these sort of things are aspects of not being prepared for the success that can happen so suddenly, that you get into a situation where your project is needs to be running 24/7 and you don't have the resources to manage it or even monitor it.
Very interesting answer, and not at all what I expected. Quite honestly, when I was writing these questions, I have the answer I'm expecting in mind, and I half expected you to simply say filtering input and escaping output, because we've seen recent examples of SQL injections taking on major sites. You would think they would know better. So, but no, that is a very thought out or well thought out answer. I appreciate that. Okay, third and final question. You've got a book out, and this is not a pitch for the book, but you do have a book out from Pragmatic titled SQL Anti-Patterns. Can you briefly explain to our listeners what is a SQL or SQL anti-pattern, and give an example or two of your favorites, or maybe sure. your least favorites? I don't know.
Exactly. Well, they're fun, so they can be my favorites. We're all familiar with design patterns for software architecture, particularly in the mm-hmm. object-oriented world. All these factories and facades and flyweight and good old singleton. All those design patterns are ways that we can notice common themes or ways of organizing our code. There was a book around 1999 called Anti-Patterns, which are common ways people design code or even run software projects that get them into more trouble than they bargained for. Solutions that seemed like the best way forward, but ended up painting themselves into a corner. So based on that idea, a couple of examples of there are like design by committee or golden hammer. If all you've got is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. Exactly. So somebody says, I'm going to use dependency injection for everything. That's a good example of an anti-pattern. So I applied that concept to SQL, since that's my field. And SQL anti-patterns are ways that people commonly and frequently use relational databases that get them into more trouble than they bargain for. Ways that they use the technology inexpertly or inappropriately as the wrong tool for a given job. So a couple of examples, you just mentioned filtering input and escaping output. That's SQL injection, and that's one of the chapters in my book. It's an amazingly common security vulnerability, which has gotten some press recently, but because of the Sony PlayStation hacks, and even MySQL.com got hacked, and there's just countless examples. It's one of the most prevalent vectors for internet security vulnerabilities in the world. Mm-hmm. So I have some presentations that I've done on that. I'm actually going to be doing that presentation again this fall at Zend conference and at Oracle Open World about methods for combating and defending against SQL injection vulnerabilities. And there's some surprises in there. I titled that talk SQL Injection Myths and Fallacies, because there's a lot of people who misunderstand the nature of SQL injection and the remedies for it. They think that there's just one thing that they can do that will catch that.
And yeah, it goes a little farther beyond just little bobby tables these days. So,
yeah, and it's an important issue for all developers to be aware of. I liken it to the electrician who sees an unsafe wiring job, and they kind of have a responsibility to fix it, even if that's not what they're originally there to, the work that they're originally there to do. So I would think that as developers, we should all bear a responsibility to self-educate about security issues, even if we aren't security specialists, and to try to follow best practices.
I agree with you totally. Bill, I thank you for your time. Real quick, before we go, what's your local user group?
The user group I go to is the San Francisco MySQL Meetup group.
And what's their URL?
Yeah, the URL is sfmysql.org.
Excellent. Bill, I want to thank you for taking the time to talk to me today. And seriously, thank you for everything that you do for the PHP community.
Glad to talk to you, Cal. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Voices of the Elephant. This podcast is copyright 2011 EICC Incorporated, and all rights are reserved. For more information on the podcast and to nominate someone to be interviewed, visit the website voicesoftheelephant.com. Elephant is, of course, spelled ELEPHPANT. Day Camp for Developers is a one-day, technology-agnostic online training camp for web developers. We cover the topics that you won't find at any other conference at a price that every developer can afford. Visit our website today, daycamp4developers.com, and reserve your seat for the next class. As a listener of Voices of the Elephant, use the discount code VOTE to save $10 off your ticket. Day Camp for Developers. Invest a day in your career.